who to call when you have ghosts. But who do you call when you have monsters?
We're the Monster Squad.
What's a squad? It's like Miami Vice, I think.
They're young and inexperienced.
Naughty virgin!
They're a bit disorganized.
Monsters are not real.
We don't know that, sir.
2,000-year-old dead guys do not get up and walk away by themselves!
Real monsters? Us? Midnight. End of world, remember? Maybe we can be like Mask Squad and Stygia. Two mask bombs.
We got a 1035. Stay back up. Hurry up.
We'll meet your squad.
The book is right. Don't you see it's all true?
By midnight.
You guys.
They won't seem so young anymore. Monster Squad.
Wolfman's gone mad.
Educational purposes only, and therefore falls under the fair use provisions of the Copyright Act of 1976. It is also presented under the auspices of the nonprofit provisions of Pop Culture Classroom, a 501c3 educational nonprofit. And this session is being presented as for credit class under PCC's ED589 Teacher Certification Program through Adams State College.
Oh, hold on.
I find your lack of fair use disturbing.
I just want to point out, yet again, this is for credits. We are now officially teaching a class.
Like, oh my
something that
God.
Cargill and I should never be allowed to do ever, and it's happening right now. So that's frightening. Welcome, everybody. Hello, Denver. How's it going? This is, of course, Junk Food Cinema. We are the weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so good it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, of course, by my friend and co-pilot, Lieutenant of Megaforce, along with the screenwriting and whatnot, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And special does not begin to, like, we are, this episode
it's
is
a rude
so
way to introduce Andre.
Yeah, it's...
Here's our special friend.
Hi.
I mean, the words right out of my mouth, obviously. We're talking about The Monster Squad, which is a movie that we love so, so much. And to not only be able to talk about this live with you folks, but also to have two of the cast members from a movie that is so important to us, this is beyond. I don't think we've ever had this before where we've had actual cast members from the movie we're talking about who get to hear in person all of our masturbation jokes. Like... I'm so happy for both of you, and please welcome with a round of applause Andre Gower and Ryan Lambert.
Who also, by the way, have recently made a film called Wolfman's Got Nards.
Yes, we will
confirmed.
We will discuss Nards shortly.
Good.
So
we will get into the Nards.
We need to get to the Nards. I'm curious of everyone sitting in here, how many of you have seen The Monster Squad? Of course you have. I am so happy to hear it. For those of you that haven't, this is a movie that ticks off so many different boxes on our list. I mean, you have foul-mouthed children, check. You have Universal Monsters, check. You have Mary Ellen Trainer, the mom of the 80s, check. You have Shane Black and Fred Decker, a check. Like this, I don't know if there are a few movies that we've talked about that have so many people and things that we love jam-packed into one 90-minute movie.
Yeah, it's even got good old fashioned classic 80s one-liners after they kill monsters.
Yes.
It could not be more of an 80s movie if it tried. And it's weird because Brian and I both have two very different experiences with it. Because I'm one of those guys who was kind of ground zero, who saw it when it came out, who saw it the day it came out on video, so they didn't get to see it in a theater. So as soon as it came out, my family used to do this thing called, you know, we'd do movie night, which every Sunday night we would make homemade pizza, and we would rent a movie and watch a movie together. I thought that was something every family did. It turns out my parents were movie nerds, and they were just training me young. And so they would let me pick a movie once a month, and so my movie was Monster Squad, and they're like, all right. And we watched it, and we had a blast with it, and we loved it. And it was just, a wonderful time. And so that was a movie that I revisited several times over the years. And so when it started getting its resurgence, I was like, oh, yeah, of course it is. Like, it's about time people start remembering and paying attention to that movie, completely unaware that it had been mostly unavailable for a while. And only then finding out that everyone's like, man, I wish we could have it on DVD. And I'm like, it's not a DVD. Like, really? It's Monster Squad. Like, why wouldn't there be a DVD? But Brian, on the other hand, walked into the cult of Monster Squad in Austin, yeah, which was going strong by the time he moved to it.
I mean, moving to Austin was such an eye-opening experience for me because there were so many movies that I had just no access to at home. And the Alamo Drafthouse became a place that would just introduce me to so many things. And I remember going to the Monster Squad reunion screening in 2009, you guys were there for, and I made it my mission during this podcast to not ask you the same 100 questions you've been asked at the myriad Q&As that you've done since then, but I'm going to start with kind of a basic one, like just what has that been for you guys? That has to be surreal, right?
2006?
Yeah.
We haven't seen each other in, very, very, very long time. I hadn't seen anybody from the cast. I was off, doing other things. And I got an email from someone named Eric Vespi that they were going to do a screening of the Monster Squad in Alamo Drafthouse in Austin, Texas. I had never even heard of Alamo Drafthouse. We don't have them in L.A. Not yet. Yeah. It's on its way. But yeah, they flew us out, and my first reaction was like, why are they doing this? Like, first of all, this movie totally tanked. I didn't know anything about, like, people had it on Laserdisc and VHS, and it like had this like underground cult thing. No clue. I never heard about it, all these years. And so I thought, oh my God, we're gonna go there, and there's gonna be like four people in the audience. And I'm like, it'll be fun, though. I've never been to Austin. We get there, and it was two sold-out screenings.
So it's sold out. It sold out the first day, and they had to immediately add a second screening,
right,
that then also sold out.
It was mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. Seeing, some of the cast again, and sort of seeing the film again. I hadn't seen it in years, so that was kind of exciting. Fred was with us in 2006. Yeah, so it was just kind of like a reunion for us, on top of actually seeing the film and seeing the reactions and some of the questions, the hundreds of questions that you're not going to ask.
That's when those started.
That's when that started. How did you feel when you were doing the scene? I'm like, wow, people are interested in this?
Yeah, it was actually neat to see that, and then to follow up with 09, and then really from that 2006 screening, that was really the seminal moment of the resurgence. And, less than a year later, we were, like, the cast was there, even the monsters were there as, like, co-headliners to a giant show called Monster Mania in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I don't know if it's giant. It's not like this big. This thing's giant. That was a big show. And it was the first convention we had ever gone to. And it was bonkers. And then all of a sudden we're doing special screenings and more Alamo stuff. And, I'm flying around doing a private screening of Monster Squad and, Q&As. And you really started to realize that there was, like, a group of people that that found it over the last 20 years that really, really liked it. And it meant something to them. So.
But I want to mention a funny little story because I don't know if we've talked about this before. But so it was a big deal. Like there was talked about trying to get a Monster Squad thing together in Austin for years. Mm-hmm. Like that was something that was kicked around, and then Eric finally went and did it. And Eric, was like, I'm pulling the trigger. I'm calling up Tim, and he got the whole thing organized. And then afterwards, I'm blanking on her name, but the actress who plays the little girl who you guys have traveled with.
Ashley Bank.
Yeah, Ashley Bank. So after that screening, Ashley and Eric went out on a date. And they dated very briefly. And so this buddy of mine went out with Ashley.
I didn't know about this. You didn't know.
I know you didn't know. You didn't know this.
But the hilarious thing is, like, because he's like, oh, yeah, no, I went out with Ashley after the screening. We went out on a date. And I'm like, the virgin? And I'm like, did you put a screening together to me? No, I did not.
Oh, it was not. Just for Anna. Great, that's funny. It was
the most elaborate
else.
Online dating I have ever heard of. That's incredible. And for those of you who haven't seen Monster Squad, I should probably explain a little bit of what the movie is about. You have a group of kids who call themselves the Monster Club, and they spend their times in. I'm sorry. No person I have ever known in my entire life has a treehouse as awesome as the treehouse that was you guys' HQ. It's absolutely fantastic, and it is filled with posters that I definitely would have had in my, like things like Vampire Circus and Fulci's Zombie and all these like really great horror movie posters just all over the place. And just discussing the ins and outs of how do you kill vampires, werewolf genitalia, like all the things that kids at the time were talking about. So Andre plays Sean, who was sort of the leader of the group, and they bring into their group the most badass kid of any 80s kid ever, Rudy, played by Ryan, and it's one of those things that when you first arrived on screen and you light that cigarette, and then not 2 minutes later they're like, he's a junior high kid. I'm like, I'm sorry, what? He's in junior high and he's like two packs a day. That is the 80s. You can't do that anymore.
No, you can't.
Now you have to vape.
Oh my God, Rudy would be vaping.
We get it, Rudy, you vape.
Oh my gosh.
You probably vape.
Is that Strawberry Surprise?
It's smashed Snickers.
Yeah,
What I want them to do? I want someone to make a vape line that is reminiscent of like Garbage Pail Kids.
Oh my
God. It's all gross shit. It's like dirty underwear and like sweaty sock.
Isn't that just what vaping is currently?
But now
it's just better labeled. I got to show it because like I'm not doing it enough justice here.
This is a good movie entrance.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our show. Tonight's question. What makes
that shithead brother from the Wonder Years?
Get out of here, EJ.
Get out of here, EJ.
No, not a good answer.
Doesn't make any sense.
Let's go to our man on the street, Derek.
Hi, I'm Derek, and I'm in the street. Fat kid is blocking traffic. Fat kid, can't you stop eating?
He puts
Look,
it out
have
like
a glandular problem,
puts
okay?
The out like a
At least I don't have a stupidity problem.
What'd you say, faggot? What'd you say?
My name's Horace.
Horace. Oops. That's all right. I guess I must have a stupidity problem.
What'd you say, faggot? What'd you say?
Shit, you're an asshole.
And just when all seems lost.
Hey, Rudy.
EJ. See, you met my friend Horace. You okay?
I was in my late 20s
Rudy,
when I first saw this, and I still wanted to grow up to be Rudy.
You dropped your candy bar, EJ.
It's his.
It's yours now.
Rudy.
Eat.
Rudy, I'm not going to see
eat
you.
Eat up. And we'll come.
So then he proceeds to make the dickhead brother from the Wonder Years eat the smashed Snickers off the ground with no physical force whatsoever.
And still the scariest horror of that scene is the rolled up jeans.
Not the penny loafers?
It's It's coming back. Like I've seen.
It's back.
Hold on. Let me roll down my jeans.
Yeah, roll them down, Ryan. Roll them down.
And I think this is something that immediately we should talk about. In that, you know, this when you look back at this movie, there are some things like in that scene. You know, there's two F-bombs that are dropped. That when you look back on it now, it kind of like makes you stir in your seat a little bit. But I think. You know, I saw the documentary, and Fred talks about the fact that, you know, that is how kids talk. And I remember, or how kids, you know, especially talked at the time. And what I think is so interesting is literally today, I was on the in the exhibition hall, and there was a kid, couldn't have been more than 16, who had said something like, just in passing, I hear this kid say, "I smell something, it smells like massive homo." Like, that's what he said, and I'm like... And it's like, yeah, it's jarring to hear that language because obviously we don't, that's not part of our lexicon as adults, but that doesn't mean that's not how kids talk, and frankly, kind of still how they talk. And I think there's something to movies in the 80s with kids in them, you know, not even necessarily kids movies, but movies where the plot revolves around kids, that they were just so authentic. And I think people are trying to say authentic to a fault now, but I'm like, no, there's a realism to that is the reason that we connected with it, whether we were kids when we saw it or when we were late 20s.
Yeah, what does authentic to a fault mean? It's
yeah.
Like not real? It's like, you are fake. Yeah, so that's bad, too. No, that you nailed it. It's the authenticity, and then played against the heart of the story and the characters kind of works.
Yeah.
Against the absurdity of the situation that we're fighting a group of universal monsters. So
yeah, and that's where we get into the antagonist, which is pretty much all of the universal monsters, starting with Duncan Rhaegar. Is, you know, everyone talks about Bela Lugosi because Bela Lugosi set the standard. I think Duncan Rhaegar may be my favorite Dracula of all time, just because he had, and I think he said it best in the documentary. He said that he played him as a sociopath, not as being sort of animalistic. It was just he just did not care. And there are so many things he does in this movie that like are just so callous that you're like, you're almost just a dick in a cape, and that's scarier. Than being a guy who can suck your blood and transform into a bat. It's just that you don't care, and you just murder, you know, at will. And I love his Dracula. So that must have been a trip working with him as a kid.
And he was, and you know, we always tell the stories like Duncan as Dracula and Tom Noonan as Frankenstein's monster. You know, played it as method. So they were only in character around us as kids on the set. So we never saw these people as other human beings. We saw them as these characters. And Duncan is, if you watch anything else, he's amazing. He's like, really, he's got this presence, and you've seen him in real life, like last year, right? At Fantastic. He's this tall, and he's gorgeous, and he's imposing, and it's like, he's got a chin that could cut glass. And he just turns and goes, "Good morning, Ryan." And you're like, "I'm out."
Yeah, I was in the elevator at the hotel just going down to meet Ashley for lunch, and I hear, "Hello, Ryan." And I was like, I don't really know him that well. I've only like met him a handful of times. But I turned around, like I totally did the full-blown Spielberg. I was like, you know, did the head turn. And there he was, and it was a glass elevator. And so he was looking outside the wind, and I'm standing like not... next to him, and he didn't he knew it was me or something.
It's reflective surfaces are an amazing
thing. Yeah.
You won't see his reflection, but he saw Ryan's, right?
That is terrifying. And I'm interested.
Well, the other terrifying thing was that we were going to get some authentic Austin barbecue. That's what me and Ashley were going to go do. And then he said, "Well, may I join you?" And I was like, I can't see Duncan, this like refined gentleman, like just chowing down like ribs and just getting all messy and stuff. And like, with all, I don't think he's ever done that.
For those of you here in Denver, the little sidebar.
Sidebar! Sidebar! Sidebar!
The barbecue exists.
Well,
is that what you were going to? That's not where you're going. Okay.
In Austin, it's not uncommon at the type of joints that he's talking about that you will be served a platter of barbecue and then a bunch of wax paper sheets,
right.
And those are your plates.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You just put it on, and sometimes if you eat with your hands, nobody judges. Like,
well, it's because we have beef ribs that look like they could topple Fred Flintstone's car.
Yeah. Right.
Like, they're so big, and you're right. The image of Duncan like eating a beef rib.
Well, what wound up happening was he kind of like took over, and like I think Ashley felt the same way as I did. So he was like, "There's a nice little bistro down the street." I'm like, "I'm gonna go to a bistro in Austin." I'm like, "All right, fine." But we go, and it's a bistro. So like the tables are so tiny, and I'm sitting here, Ashley's sitting there, and he's sitting across from me, but his face is like right here because it's. And it was just so intimidating and bizarre and weird because we had never really hung out in this capacity before. And so asking him about, you know, his life and like what he's been up to, and he's been painting and you know, he lives in Canada. So and then he's asking me about my life. I'm like, you don't want to know what I've been, you know, you're not interested in like my rock bands in San Francisco. Like, he doesn't care about that stuff. So it was just really awkward.
And the problem comes in for our young heroes when apparently every monster you've ever heard of is currently in transit through this one town, because first they're transporting Dracula's coffin in an airplane, and then Dracula's plan, once he is released, is to gather together Frankenstein's monster, the creature from the Black Lagoon, and the Wolfman. Now, one of the things that it took me many viewings to realize, all the creature effects in this movie, this is not the part I didn't know, are done by the great Stan Winston and his team. What I didn't know is that he had to kind of work around copyright. He didn't actually have the rights to make the actual Universal Monsters, which is why the creature is called Gillman, and why there's just a very distinct look, why Frankenstein's monster has the bolts in the forehead and not in the neck. It's kind of, you know, Cargill and I really love the genre of the Italian knockoff movie, where in the 80s the Italians would look at whatever was making money in the States and go, we can do that for $100, and they would just rip it off. And what I love is Stan Winston is kind of making his Italian knockoff version of the Universal Monsters that looks so good because he's Stan Winston that you don't even question the fact that they don't look exactly like the Universal Monsters.
They wouldn't just rip off these movies, by the way. They would rip off titles because they didn't have IP laws. So, like, we've been recently talking about this movie, Sudden Dark, or what's the...
Shocking Dark.
Shocking Dark, which came out in 1989 that they titled Terminator 2.
Yes.
Now, the real Terminator 2 wasn't out yet. They didn't think there was going to be a sequel, so they just titled their movie Terminator 2.
Now,
but
it's a ripoff of Aliens.
There it is.
So it's a ripoff of Aliens titled preemptively as a ripoff to something. Like, that is the brilliance of that, is that they're so good at ripping things off, they can rip off things that haven't even come out yet.
That's pretty talented. That's a skill.
But yeah, Stan Winston's work on those monsters and working around the IP to like, yeah, no, we can technically use these characters because they belong in fiction,
right.
But we can't use the universal versions of these monsters, created some really great looks. Like, I love the look of Gillman in this more than I like any other creature from the Black
Lagoon. It's not quite as fuckable as Duncan Jones, but it is...
Duncan Jones?
What did I say?
You said Duncan Jones, as in the director
him too.
Of... the director of Moon.
Sure, whatever. Whatever. The point is, it's
Doug
not
Jones.
Doug Jones. It's not quite as fuckable as Doug Jones, but it is. There's a sexiness to that Gillman. I'm not gonna lie. Have I said too much?
No, you're right. And what's interesting about that is the.
Damn you, Andre.
The team that split up to make individual stuff. All these young apprentice and kind of new creature makers that are working for this guy, Stan Winston, who really wasn't an icon yet, because he had done two movies.
Right.
Alien and Terminator. And I think worked on Predator, too. So they did, because they came in and saved Predator and remade Predator, but that was a little, the timing is kind of overlaps. But all these young guys are kind of reimagining these creatures and making this stuff, and now if you look at it today, all of those guys that made our monsters are the biggest names in creature effects in Hollywood today.
Including the guys that actually made Doug Jones's creature in Shape of Water.
Right.
Which
and
is absolutely
Shane
incredible.
Mahan, who is a co-owner of Legacy Effects, helped work on Amphibian Man from Shape of Water, along with a guy named Mike Hill, who has sort of a really neat full circle story with Monster Squad 2, being a kid in the UK seeing this movie. And you'll get his story, that full circle thing, which he actually doesn't realize until he's giving his interview. We knew it, because that's why we wanted the interview. And he just realizes it, like, on the chair in the documentary. And it turns out pretty good. And this is, Shape of Water hadn't even come out yet when we did his interview. And so it was pretty neat to get him there, and then that wins the Oscar and all this stuff. So, but no effects awards, just an Oscar.
Yeah.
Nothing was nominated for the effects, which was kind of crazy.
But it is such an amazing team of people that came together on this. I mean, we've already kind of mentioned Shane Black, who, you know, you mentioned Predator. We have a joke on the show that Shane Black was kidnapped and taken to the jungle so that he could do rewrites for Joel Silver. And that's how, like, it's not exactly how he ended up in the movie, but it's not far off.
I think it's not far off.
It's not far off from how he ended up in the movie. But you know, you have Shane Black writing it. You have Fred Decker, who is so visionary in the worlds that he creates wherever you have someone, you have these heroes that are kids, that are young people. Like, it is such a staple of the 80s, and I think whenever that happens, we tend to associate it with Spielberg and the Amblin model. But you know, Fred Decker was somebody for me with Night of the Creeps and with Monster Squad, who was able to do that just as well. And I love that it's not just a matter of, like, you know, the adults don't believe us. It's these kids are in peril. These kids are taking on things that are, like, that any adult would shit their pants trying to thwart. So that's one of the things I really love about Monster Squad, is seeing you guys kind of go back and forth between taking charge and, like, yeah, we're going to do this. We're a squad now. And then of course, the line immediately, what's a squad? I don't know. It's like Miami Vice. So it's like having no idea what you're doing and then going back and forth between being petrified and, no, we have to do this. And I think that's best exemplified. Ryan, I'm almost intimidated to talk to you because of how cool and how, like, imposing Rudy is in the movie. So I'm curious, when you know, Fred is working with you, did he give you any kind of guidance on, like, what type of persona he was looking for? Was he looking for any kind of specific, like, did he give you any, like, exemplars to kind of use?
Through the script, it's on the page. You can see it. It's basically like, yep, and you get it right away. Like, you're like, yeah, leather jacket, smokes, you know, it was all there.
Rolled up jeans,
loafers.
More than likely has already lost his virginity in junior high. It's, you know, I can't verify it.
The thing that really put me in that character fully was actually the wardrobe lady. I can't remember her name, but she was fitting me for jackets, and they had like five or six, and she put on the one that I eventually wear in the film, and she goes, I think this is it. And I said, you know, this just doesn't feel like me. I don't know, it just doesn't feel like me. And she goes, you're not playing you. And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. I've got to, like, go overboard on this. Like, this guy has to be, like, you know, super, super badass.
And has, I think, one of the, like, these movies that, you know, some of us watched as kids, some of us watched as big kids in their late 20s, has those hero moments, especially when the hero moments are occupied by kids. There's something so magical about that, and something that makes me love those scenes even more. And there's two in particular in this movie, and Rudy, Ryan, you have the first one. I told
it's
you,
fine.
I'm intimidated. Like,
oh, shit.
This line of dialogue, I repeat so many times.
Wait, I'm fucking German. Ich bin ein Gertschein. Damn, you really, you should read it.
He's not a virgin, you stupid.
Did you ask him? Where you going, Rudy?
I'm in the goddamn club, aren't I?
Yes!
I love it. And then proceeds to, like, Hawkeye all of the brides of Dracula. Like, that
all
is...
All three.
That's amazing.
Wait. We can play the tape.
Dude, we need to.
There's only two on-screen confirmed kills.
Oh, this is...
Wow.
Wow, throwing shade.
The third one's implied. I'm not saying he didn't do it. I'm just saying it's implied. That's all. There's some other shit that could have happened.
So it's been 30 years. Are you keeping score? Are you like, how many did Sean take down versus how many Rudy took down?
One. I know. One. I get it. I get it.
No, it's fine. I mean, it's.
I got the mummy, I got the wolf man, and the three vamp chicks.
two vamp chicks.
I mean,
thirds implied.
Andre, you got just as many monsters as one of the other monsters got, so your numbers are pretty good, right?
Oh, I'm not. I'm like an accuracy guy.
I was with three chicks once. One confirmed, two implied.
So you see my point.
I guess no, I
we,
do.
We started giving shit on that, like just in the last year or two, because it's just funny. It's like, no, I killed three vampires. I'm like, wait, did you?
Now it's all no. You know what? Now it's gonna. You're gonna open the floodgates for like it was all in Rudy's head and all these like retcon theories, like. Oh.
There's actually a director's cut shot of him staring at a snow globe at the end.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yes. The greatest Monster Squad director's cut ever. And then this, of course, is the other great hero moment.
Hey, fat kid.
Good job.
My name.
You can't beat that.
Dirty Harry's the shit out of this movie.
Yeah.
I love it so much. I don't know. There's something just that will always, like, no matter how old I get, that will always resonate with me of when kids have to be like, well, if the adults can't get this shit done, I guess it's up to us. Like, there's something so fantastic about that. I think this movie, in that vein, of course, double features very well with The Goonies, and I already mentioned it once before. Uh-oh.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, bye.
No. All right. Well, this has been Junk Foods.
You're not allowed to say that word.
That's fine. I still think Monster Squad's better.
Goonies are fine. Goonies are fine.
I watched Andre get in a fist fight with a woman over it.
Women? Accuracy counts.
It was just one woman.
One confirmed.
One confirmed. Okay, good.
And it wasn't a boxing ring. Totally sanctioned. Totally sanctioned by the Alamo Draft.
Totally happened. It was somebody arguing Goonies versus Monster Squad, and then they boxed.
No contest. The only reason I bring up the G word is that those two movies have the distinction of both of the moms played by Mary Ellen Trainer.
Yes.
And I remember watching both of these movies and going, wait, hold on.
How many kids does she have?
How many kids? And her job as a news reporter, Gail Wallins, in the Die Hard, in the Joel Silververse.
And as the psychiatrist in Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, so she's everywhere. Like, she is such a mainstay of this decade. And I thought it was always funny to me that she was the mom in both movies.
She's great.
But yeah, just I also love the fact that, you know, as much as I love Duncan Rager, there's knowing that Liam Neeson was almost cast as Dracula in this movie is really fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Like,
so he came in to read for Dracula and was like, good, but Duncan killed it, I guess.
Yeah,
in his audition.
No, they made
and
the
maybe
right
literally choice. Killed somebody in the audition. I'm not sure, right? He probably went, you're dead. And the guy went,
one.
But then they were going, they said, well, we like this other guy that was in Krull, and let's, being Liam Neeson.
Because at that time, that's what you knew Liam Neeson from, was he was the barbarian in Krull.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. The sixth lead in Krull or something, right? And which is a great movie, which should totally be remade.
Funny story.
I think someone was saying they were remade.
The fifth lead in Krull is the glaive. So right, I mean, it's a tough gig, really.
Which I think the new Predator has a glaive. Right?
Okay. We need to talk about this.
Okay, well, do we?
Well, hang on. Let me go back to Liam Neeson and this thing, because there's a scene that was in the script that was sort of a longer, deeper scene in the Scary Mansion where we find the amulet. And I always lament that it's not in the movie because it's a great scene. And that whole thing was supposed to be much deeper and like kind of like a Scooby-Doo chase scene, like at different levels. It ended up happening on one, but we go in. Well, you're off getting the other stuff.
He's off killing all the monsters.
I know.
Yeah, okay.
And Horace and Eugene and I walk into the mansion, and there's a guy there. And I'm like, who's this guy? And I can't remember if he was supposed to be like, I'm Van Helsing's great-grandson, or he was like a real estate agent. I don't remember. And but he was like, here, can you, you know, come in and help me, you know, help me with this thing or whatever. And so we get deeper and deeper in this house, and we walk past this kind of like busted mirror, and we just had the setup with Scary German Guy. He said, if I was a vampire, I wouldn't have a reflection. Cut to this scene, and we're walking in this group, and he's not there. And it's just this like floating mask type of thing, and it's Dracula being deceptive and hiding behind this thing to lure us to get the amulet out, and then he can kill us. And I think they were supposed to have Liam Neeson as that guy. And I think he was on set to shoot that scene. They just never shot it. They rewrote that scene like on the day as we were doing it because of time or something.
Which leads me to a question that I'm curious about. Shane Black's original draft for this was 30 pages longer. Did you guys ever see that?
I think it was 300 pages longer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the version he
and
told
the
me about
the first
was
act
30.
Would have been the entire budget. Yeah, no, you're probably right. It was.
Yeah, because he was.
He had an opening with like Zeppelins.
Yeah, it was like Zeppelins and like the Greek army invading the shores of Troy.
Like 15 years ago when he had this huge career, and then he and his wife got divorced, and he was just kind of creatively tapped for a few years, and he would come down to Austin and hang out with a bunch of young screenwriters and tell old war stories. And because he's Shane, when Shane wants to hold court, you let Shane hold court. And
no idea what that's like.
And he he just starts telling the story about, because we asked him about I heard that. He starts telling the story. We asked him about Monster Squad, and he's like, oh, yeah, no, I love that movie, but it's not the movie it was supposed to be. Like, I had this draft that was 30 pages longer. And for years, every time he would come down, he'd be like, I looked this year, and I it's not in my files. I can't find it. But he promised for years to bring down this mythical 30-page longer draft of Monster Squad.
Yeah, he can't find it. He likes that draft. That's one of his apparently the favorite things that he's written, but he don't know where it is. Like, he can't find it. But we always talk about the stuff that in that draft and that original that's not in the movie or even the shooting script, because it really gave a lot more backstory and undercarriage to the kids and the squad about how much they knew about what they were talking about, and you know, kind of the whole thing where the parents don't understand or the adults aren't getting it and we have to do it. And we kind of fly through this movie. And this movie's only like 82 minutes long.
It is brisk.
And it just goes...
It's amazing. Yeah.
And I always watch the movie and it's... I lament the payoffs that we don't get because we have the setups, and then there's setups that we don't get the payoffs, and payoffs that are there, you don't know their payoffs because you never got the setup because it wasn't shot.
Yeah.
You name some of your favorites for us?
Well, my favorite one is that scene with the guy in the house, but probably the other one is, you know, they have the crawl at the beginning of the movie where it's like 100 years ago, you know, a band of freedom fighters, Van Helsing, da-da-da, they blew it. No, there's no explanation of how they blew it, because they attack the castle, they blow a hole in Limbo, and Van Helsing and the skeletons come out, and it's over. But we don't know how they blew it, and what it is they actually shot a scene where they capture Dracula in the woods and stake him against a tree, and he's dead. Then they go into the castle to do the thing, and they put him in a cart. They put him in this wagon, and he's dead, and he's got the stake in his heart, and he's laying in this open wagon, and they leave like a guy to guard the camp while they go do the castle thing. And of course it's like a red shirt, and so he's sitting there by the campfire guarding the Dracula's body, and out of the woods come three vampire brides, which the payoff to that is Rudy's action sequence at the very end.
So there's only two
right. And so this guy comes and he shoots her with his crossbow, and she goes down, and then the other one's close, and he grabs a stake and kills her, and then the other one gets him.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, and he grabs a stake and goes, oh, shh, and gets it. He's like, oh, I made it. But what he doesn't realize is he unstaked Dracula, and of course that brings a vampire back to life. That's how they blew it.
Yeah.
So he escapes, they blow him, and then now Dracula is walking around for the next 100 years because he's not in Limbo.
Okay.
He gets away.
So that's how they blew it. Okay.
And he's just walking around.
I'm just
like any town USA waiting for us.
I would love to see that. I'm also really glad you mentioned red shirts, because there's a great piece of, speaking of costuming in the movie, where you are walking around the entire movie as Sean wearing a shirt that says Stephen King rules.
Yeah.
That's a great shirt. I got this one at the 2009 screening because I was like, yes, that is something that I had a cool T-shirt place in my hometown. That totally is something that I would have worn. And I love it.
I think that lends to the fact of what like the original story was with these kids, of how much they knew and what they were going to do, and like what 13-year-old reads Stephen King, you know, and like, oh my God, he knows all this stuff, and
right.
And in the script, it says, yeah, and Sean, you know, kind of a geeky kind of kid is sitting in the principal office wearing a shirt that has his own homemade iron-on letters that says Stephen King rules. So you know he probably gets beat up wearing that shirt in sixth grade or seventh grade or something. But he doesn't care. He's like, this is mine.
Yeah. I'll wear this out and people will be like, oh, I'm a big fan too. I'm like, of Monster Squad? And they're like, no, Stephen King.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, right. Sorry.
But when you find a Monster Squad fan, they know it. They know it, and they're like, cool. You're like, oh, okay, I got it.
Yeah, and monsters aren't the only thing you guys are dealing with in this movie. There's a lot of. This is the other thing I really love about it is there's a lot of weight behind just this, the family life in this movie. Like Andre's parent, I'm going to keep doing this. Sean's parents are on a rickety wagon, plummeting down a mountain toward Divorce Town, and it is. Like, there's literally a fight where you are, like, trying to unscramble the letters of Dracula, and it's like this plot. And meanwhile, your parents are having this, like, really heated fight, and I'm just like, should we be talking about that? Because that seems really severe.
Yeah, I think they underserved that scene, too, because I think Steven and Mary Ellen went at it for, like, an entire morning on set, and they just used the POV through the blinds. And, yeah, I mean, like, my family's breaking apart, like, the parents, because what a lot of people didn't get being a movie that no one had access to for so long is when you saw the VHS, if anybody had the VHS, that's compressed and it's not widescreen. And you missed two huge things, not only in a script that didn't get made, but in not widescreen, and two very important things. And there's a scene later on where you see it, but you can't see the bottom by the stairs, and there's suitcases. She's leaving.
Oh, Jesus.
She's out while all this shit starts happening.
And then meanwhile, does the Wolfman have nards? Right. I don't know. I'm having this discussion, so I don't have to talk about my parents splitting up.
And then there's a great scene with Phoebe and the mom. That's their little moment. And she goes, are you going to yell at him? And he's like, I love your father. She goes, no, I mean Sean for scaring me. It's a great scene, but they're talking about the candle.
Yeah.
And she goes, it keeps the lightning, keeps the bad stuff away. And she goes, yeah, as long as the candle's on, nothing bad to happen. You go to sleep. Great. And then later on, you don't see it. Unless it's widescreen, the candle blinks out while she's putting something in the closet.
Dude.
And so you have to watch either the DVD or the Blu-ray or watch it on 35 so to actually get those little things.
Kids versus monsters and Kramer versus Kramer, apparently.
Right.
That is insane to me. But also, again, one of the big reasons why I love this movie so much is that much like some of the other movies that we love in the 80s, like, kids were allowed to deal with shit. Like, in this case, you're literally dealing with monsters in your closet, but there's so many other things going on that kind of play as a metaphor to that. And I have one question, though. As far as, like, we've talked about all these amazing people in the movie, knowing how much we love Night of the Creeps and that came before this one, how on God's green earth is Tom Atkins not your father in this movie?
There's a reason. I think that would have been amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it would have been a completely different movie. Stephen Mock's great. I love Stephen Mock. But apparently during casting, Peter Hyams, who was a big director and a producer of this movie, his wife loved Stephen Mock on, like, General Hospital. And said, I want that guy. So Peter was, like, in charge of casting that. And he said, do you know why you're here? And Steven goes, no. He goes, because my wife loves you. He goes, have you read the script? He's like, yeah, it's cute. He's like, do you want to do it? Because it's yours. So, hence, Del Crenshaw is Stephen Mock.
Because of General Hospital.
Because of General Hospital and Peter Hyams' wife, according to Stephen Mock. That's the story.
Peter Hyams is a filmmaker we've talked about no fewer than half a dozen times.
Yeah, he's great. But to go back to your point on all this complexities and stuff that's going on with these characters, we've had really good conversations over the last couple of years with Ryan's character, Rudy, that, yeah, is he the badass and the cool kid? Yes. But we have, you have this great take on it to where he's actually not that kid. That's all, like, a facade, all the mask of just finding some way of dealing with whatever he's dealing with, right?
Sure. Yeah. I always throw that in there. Like, this kid is probably not who you think he is. I think he really wants to belong to something, And so, you know, he doesn't. I mean, when they meet, there's no monsters yet. I mean, they don't know that this is going on. And then this like junior high kid wants to hang out with these little dweebs.
Yeah.
In a clubhouse. I mean,
confirmed dweebs.
Yeah. three confirmed dweebs. So there's got to be something else is going on in this kid's life, and I think he just needs to belong. But the clothes are just kind of like you were saying, just like a mask to what he really is. I mean, he is kind of a badass. I mean, but there's something else going on.
Oh, for sure.
When you guys premiered your film at Chattanooga, did you guys manage to catch Summer of 84?
Yes.
There's a great horror film that's making the circuit right now that will eventually come out called Summer of 84, and there's kind of a riff on Rudy in that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They go that direction with it.
Right, yeah.
Which I found really fascinating. And so this is the first time that I've heard you actually talk about that and putting that together. That's really kind of an interesting dichotomy there.
Yeah, those guys actually became kind of buds of mine.
Yeah,
we Facebook.
Still... Oh, RKS is the best.
Yeah, that's,
they're the best bonkers, people.
Right? Super bonkers.
And I think we should, the other seminal part of this movie that gets repeated, this line that is quoted so much, will segue us into something really cool that I want to talk about. So let's just watch.
So let's just try to find the amulet. And get the hell out of here.
That's me, by the way.
That's me.
That's Cargill. Wolfman's got nards, which is such a great like it sounds like just a line to be funny, but it's such a great payoff to all of the sort of hypothetical discussions that you guys had, you know, in the Monster Club, and it pays tribute to all of the ridiculous conversations we've always had as kids, like would you know Batman, you know, win in a fight with the Flash or Superman if they made a really bad movie about that?
Does the thing from the Fantastic Four have a rock dork?
Yes, exactly. Like so much time spent on superhero and monster genitalia in our youth. But it kind of segues into, we've talked about it, the documentary, which is, of course, called Wolfman's Got Nards, that not only are we all super excited about, but we actually get to premiere the trailer for here during this panel. So I'm super excited about that. So we're going to get that queued up here. But do you want to talk just a little bit about the documentary?
Yeah, if anybody has a chance, we're on the festival kind of run now. We just premiered back in April, and you know, I made this documentary over the last year. Basically, the inspiration for it was, you know, going over the last decade or so, having all of these great stories that these fans come up and say, you don't understand what this movie means to me, this is my favorite movie of all time. And we started to realize that they have this really deep and strong connection to this movie for some reason, whether they... you know, connect with the character or the storyline or even the monsters or whatever. And I was like, those stories are a story. I'd like to tell that. And how do I put that together? And I got very lucky to team up with a studio at Pilgrim Studios and 1620 Media to produce this documentary during the 30th anniversary year while we were out on the road doing a lot of appearances and Alamo Drafthouse tours and special screenings. And we are, it's done and it's out. And we're actually doing a screening here at Denver Comic Con tomorrow night in this room, right? It's in this room, right, David?
In this room, yes.
So it's in this room tomorrow at 6 if you want to come by and see this documentary, because it'll be way ahead of when the next time you'll get to see it, either in town or when it's released. So,
and it's really good.
It's really good.
they've both seen it, yes. Yeah, Cargo, you saw it in a theater with people, and then you saw it on the link, so it's two different ways to see it. But so thanks
yeah,
for
no,
viewing
we
it.
Yeah, we saw it at that screening at Chattanooga where you're like, I just hope a couple people show up. And then the room was just filled with filmmakers who were all there because we all grew up on this movie and love this film. And you guys were just like, how the hell did so many people, like, it's, you know, Jen Wexler was there, and RKS was there. And,
yeah, I just want, you know, when you're a filmmaker at a festival, like when you're a patron and a fan, you're like, oh, I don't care, I hope no one's in this theater, I want to be by myself, watch this movie. But when you're making a movie and your name's on, you're like, I just hope people show up.
So here now is the world premiere of the trailer for Wolfman's Got Nards.
Yeah, so we found out we're not allowed to play you guys the trailer, so instead I'm just going to make some monster noises and shit. So I'd grrr, and
Wolfman's got nards! I'm Joe Lynch, and I like the Blob, and I'm in this movie. Oh my god, so cool. And I'm Adam Green, and I like this movie too. Okay. It's the Movie Crypt. Sorry, I just always wanted to do that.
So there's the trailer. That's it, right? The first time anybody's seen the trailer for this movie.
Imagine if the documentary Best Worst Movie was about a good movie. Because there is the same for... Like, a big part of what I love about doing this podcast is there is an element of sort of cinema archaeology where we're digging for movies that, you know, have fallen out of the public eye or people just don't talk about as much anymore, but they're so great and deserve to kind of be put back into the forefront. And that's a lot of what this documentary is about, and the idea that that movies are kind of immortal, that like a lot of the monsters, it's hard to kill them. They will come back, and I think that's what the documentary does such a good job of digging into, is that the people that have kept this movie alive with their fandom really speaks to not only the fandom for Monster Squad, but the fandom for cult movies in general. And when you find that movie that you love, whether or not anyone else has ever seen it, it is so personal and so important to you. And then when you find out that there are all these other people who know about this movie, who will, you know, come to a panel about it and watch the trailer for a documentary about it, and you get so excited because you are not alone, it's a very moving thing. And that's why I was so moved by it, is it's not just how great Monster Squad is and the really interesting story of the cult that is built around it in its second life. It's really about why we love the movies we love in the first place.
Because that's what we were going for.
Okay.
That's good. So good.
So I can put these notes away then. No,
That and a lot of Joe Lynch.
And there's a lot of Joe Lynch in this.
Any Joe Lynch in that trailer, surprisingly.
He's just in the doc just enough. But you know his on-camera interview was at least 2 hours.
Oh,
you know,
well,
if anybody
and
knows
it had
Joe
Zeppelins,
Lynch.
Well, and there were
anyone here who listens to the podcast regularly knows Joe Lynch. So
you can barely get a word in edgewise, but it's amazing. It's just bonkers. But thank you for viewing that. Hopefully nobody videoed that and going to release that thing. I forgot to ask not to do that yet, so it's good.
No, junkions are good people.
We're getting ready to. There's going to be a big kind of, not a big media drop, but a media drop here very shortly while our festival run. And then hopefully it goes well in the festivals and people like you talk about it and tweet about it. And, you know, we get a good release situation and get it distributed. And you can get it on Blu-ray or see it at your theater or on some streaming service, yeah.
Without having to petition Lionsgate to be able to watch it on...
That's right. This is an instance that we're in control of. That's one of my main things with this doc, is that there will be a physical media component to this documentary, which sounds weird as a documentary. No one buys and collects documentaries, but this isn't really that typical type thing.
Put it out on VHS.
Yeah, I you know how many people have asked me to do that?
How about two more? Put it out on VHS.
We might just have to put it out on VHS. And I think this is a neat component piece. Does anybody have Monster Squad stuff at home, or like the movies or old poster or anything like that? You know, most people have more than one thing and they just stack up their collection. Yeah. And hopefully this will be one more piece right at the end of that and kind of close off a nice 30 years.
This is the first time we've done a podcast with people who are on posters in my room. Now, don't get me wrong. I was kind of hoping it'd be Adrian Barbeau. But it's so remarkable the life that this movie has taken on. And I feel like guilty that I wasn't aware of its existence until the second run, but I definitely love the hell out of this. I'm so glad we got to talk about it. I'm so glad you guys were here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us,
Andre and Ryan, for joining us, and thanks
you.
To all of you. Now,
thank you. I would, it's because we get awesome fans to come to stuff like this or screenings, and Ryan and I get the chance to enjoy the ridiculous shit that we get to have fun with in the last 10 years, and we didn't see each other for 15, 16 years or something like that, and then now we've spent a lot of time together the last 10 years, and we work on projects now, and talk about Monster Squad bringing things together, people together. It's really, we've got our own inside thing, and we work on projects. We have our own podcast, which if anybody wants to watch, it's called Squadcast.
Squadcast!
So, yeah, Squadcast.
What?
It's called Squadcast with Ryan and Andre, and we actually just flipped it over into, like, video podcast And it's on a Patreon page. So that's a new thing for us, and so we're checking that out. So please follow us or tweet us or
Patreon.com/Ryan and Andre.
Yep. Check us out there, Ryan and Andre, and we'll just hang out. That's what it's about, right?
You mentioned ridiculous shit, and I want to end the show the way we always do with our junk food pairing. And for this one, I actually went out and got Snickers and crushed every single one of them. And there's enough here for all of you to have some. So if you would like to come up and grab yourself a smashed Snickers and really feel what it's like to be the dickhead older brother from the Wonder Year. I'm sorry.
But wait, I think Ryan has to tell them to eat it.
Yes, that's true. So get
close
one of
it
these,
out with that.
And then Ryan will tell you all to eat it.
And we'll call it a day.
I hereby declare this meeting adjourned.